Hey, welcome to Public Words Project. It's a very special episode. It's a very special episode because I have someone sitting in front of me who I love and adore. And I don't mean to take away from anybody else who I've been speaking to, but I've known this young lady for a while.
That's true.
Yes. She's intelligent, compassionate, articulate, smarter than I am. I know that for sure.
I don't know about all that.
One of the things I like about this young woman is that you are probably the most compassionate person I ever met in my entire life. You have compassion for so many different people in this world, true compassion, and you put your political energy and your soul behind it. So I just want to applaud you for that, Jen Spinner.
Thank you. I don't know if it's warranted, but I do appreciate it.
So we have Jennifer Spinner here. Yay!
Yay.
Welcome back to Los Angeles, sister.
Thank you. It's good to be back. Maybe permanently.
This is a tease. We're just going to leave it right where it is. So, Jen Spinner, tell me your name, full name, what you do for a living, and where you're from.
Sure. I'm Jennifer Elise Spinner. Actually, I'm Jennifer Elise Broadway Spinner.
Oh, that's right.
Yes. I work for Human Rights Watch. I am a grant writer there, but I also work on their program a little bit. And I am from New York, from Long Island, New York.
Tell me a little bit about your place of employment.
Sure. Human Rights Watch is amazing. They started the whole name and shame idea of activism. So they investigate human rights abuses all over the world, and then they expose them through reporting, and then they advocate to push for change. So they were, and now they've started doing satellite imagery. So they were one of the first people to go into Myanmar and prove that, the Rohingya were having a genocide going on there. And they actually, they create change at the UN level, at the local level, at the national level. It's pretty great.
You're impressive. You're impressive on
They're
so many levels.
very impressive.
Yes. Well, they hired you and I got to speak to them, so I'm impressed by them and by you. And you know what? When I give you a compliment, you could just say thank you,
I know,
sister.
that's why I've heard that before.
Public Words Project is about helping people getting comfortable in their own
Yes.
skin and giving tips and coaching. So here's my only coaching tip for you. Just say thank you because
All
you're
right.
worth all the
Thank
compliments.
you.
You are worth every compliment, sister.
I'm gonna try it out. Thank you.
Okay. So we know your name. We know where you work. I would like to know where you're from.
Sure. I'm from Miracle on Island, which is a suburb of New York City. It's about 45 minutes from Manhattan. It's a pretty small, like 22,000 people, Jewish.
You're Jewish.
I'm
Oh my
Jewish. I'm
God. You
Jewish.
fit into the category of being
I
Public Works
am very
Project.
Jewish. And yeah, it's a small place. Everyone sort of knows each other. I went to high school with Lindsay Lohan. That's what most people know about it. And Debbie Gibson.
There you go.
But it's sort of, I call it a purple state. It's very socially progressive and financially conservative.
Okay.
There it's a very like everyone, no one leaves. Everyone's been there forever. It's Jewish and Italian, so there's a lot of like family oriented.
Nice
Yeah.
food too. Manja,
Good food, really
manja.
good food. Everyone I went to high school with pretty much still lives there.
Okay.
And yeah.
So you're not there. You were
I'm
there.
not there.
You will you I met you here in Los
I got
Angeles.
out.
Yeah. You got out.
I got out.
But we'll go fast forward to that at another point, but I want to get back to like so you're from where you
From Merrick.
Merrick. And then you live on the East Coast right
I
now.
do. I live in New York.
New York.
New York,
Whoop.
or Brooklyn. I live in
Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, New York.
Brooklyn.
Brooklyn in the house.
That's I got my very favorite t-shirt from when I first visited you.
Greenpoint.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I wore that in your honor. I wear that t-shirt
Yeah.
all the time.
Greenpoint's great. I
It
love
grew.
Greenpoint.
That's when I was like, "Ooh, I think I need to come over here." And then we ate at that fantastic Hungarian restaurant.
Yes, we did. Yes. Greenpoint is the melting point pot of Brooklyn for sure.
Okay, so there's two questions I ask everybody at the top of the interview. What is your favorite word?
My favorite word, probably like, because I say it all the time. in between every other word that I say. So I guess by default, that would be my favorite.
Okay.
Most frequented.
Okay, we'll go with that. And then what's your favorite food?
Definitely pad thai.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Thai food is my ultimate
pad thai. Got
weakness.
It.
It's kryptonite.
You're the first person. So like,
really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's the addiction. I mean, my wife is going to get Thai food right now for me.
That's fantastic. So I didn't know that was it. See?
My favorite. Ultimate favorite. Okay. I can have Thai food every day of the week and never get sick of it ever.
Recalling to my memory how many times we had Thai food, but we haven't
had
Thai food.
Oh, I love Thai food, yeah.
Okay, so we're going to do a little background on you. So where did you grew up, and what was that experience like where you grew up?
It was, you know, there weren't any other gay people where I grew up. There weren't any other...
You're gay?
I am gay.
Oh, my God.
Shocking.
Jewish and
the
gay.
Wife is not male. yeah, I grew up, you know, it's weird. There weren't any gay people. However, I was part of a youth group from my temple, and that was very LGBT oriented. We did services around social justice and activism. You know, there were kids that were out. They were like 11 years old. You know, and in the Jewish camp that I went to, there was Torah study, and a lot of the Torah study was questioning some of the anti-LGBT stances that Judaism takes. So, religiously and with my friends, there was a lot of acceptance. My family was never not accepting of gay people, but it was sort of a non-issue. Mm-hmm. And so...
Lovely.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it didn't come up, which I think in my mind meant that they were not for the idea of like one of their kids being gay, which happens luckily to not be the case.
Right.
But yeah, I grew up with 5 siblings, so a lot of kids in the house. My parents got divorced. I lived primarily with my dad and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's definitely a very big, bold, loud family.
Mm-hmm. I remember the first time I met your wedding weekend.
Yeah,
I met your
family. They're real. They're just putting it all out.
They're joy. They're complete joy. I remember I was just sitting there just taking it all in.
Amazing. They're
and
show.
I'm loud and an extrovert and kind of like,
They'll drain any extrovert. They're a TV show. My friend said that that it should be called Surviving the Spinners, and it would be a hit reality show. And she's right.
Okay, everyone who's... Okay, so we now have 4 listeners. So the 4th person, if you're in the industry, we got a new sitcom for you.
There we go.
Yeah, I could see that happening.
Surviving the Spinners. Yeah. What I love about them, though, and what they taught me is that there's no private and public with them. And I sort of love that. Like, they're who they are. Mm-hmm. They're not going to change. I've asked them to, like, you know, this person's coming over. Can you just do this? And they're like, no, don't bring them over. So
that's awesome.
I respect that. And like sometimes maybe they do need to chill, but if they're upset, they're upset and they're going to express it no matter where they are. If they're happy, they're going to express it. And, you know, I think that there's an authenticity to aspire to there that I don't see in a lot of other families. So
it's a gift.
Yeah. It's a gift and a curse, but
so with talking about your family, what's your favorite family memory you have right now that you want to share with everybody?
My favorite family memory. Wow. I think my favorite family memory would probably be before my parents got divorced, we went to Disney World, and it was probably the last time that we were, my brother, sister, myself and my parents were together, and it was a great trip and we had a ton of fun. And I feel like everyone, which was rare, everyone was just positive. And it was just a really additive experience. There was nothing that was, you know, detracting from an amazing week. So that was probably one of my favorites.
That's beautiful. That's
nice. I enjoyed it. Yeah. It was fun.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you and I didn't ask earlier is like where did you get your education?
So I went to Syracuse University for my undergrad, and that was amazing.
What was your undergrad in?
It was public policy, women's studies, and marketing. And then a minor in conflict management and de-escalation. So I was a triple major with a minor. A little weird.
I love the minor.
Yeah, it was.
I did not know that about you.
Yeah, so I did this conflict management course, certification. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I got my undergrad there and then pretty much moved to LA within 8 months after that, after graduating from there. So.
And right now you're working on your master's degree.
I am at SUNY Albany. I just finished my last class of the semester tonight.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So yeah, that will be in international affairs. So
you always aim so low, sister. You're just like, you know, you're just such a low achiever.
Although I will say that I think it's completely classist and ridiculous that you need a master's, because my professors keep saying, but you already know this stuff because you've been working for since you're 18. I'm like, well, yes, I do, but
I have to put that money
need
down,
a master's,
and get that paper,
need to go into debt, get ahead. But yes, I'm getting my master's right now.
Good for
finally.
You. Finally. Good for you. I know you're busy. You're newly married.
Newly married.
Traveling around. You just started this fantastic new job.
Yes.
And then you're throwing your master's degree on top of it. So
yeah. Gotta aim high. Figured get it all done when I still have energy.
Right.
Do it.
And then you have a wonderful dog, Huck.
I do have a wonderful dog, Huck, who is a frequent visitor in class because I am a remote student. And he is now as a part of my master's as I am.
We gotta give him a little cap and gown.
My professor was saying they're gonna give him like a little honorary. He's been in every class, so.
We're gonna have to give him a little certificate, his own little master's degree, you know, and.
Most educated dog.
You have always been so, you know, I've known you for a while, and like when you first got that dog, I remember standing with somebody who was an associate, a friend of yours at the time, in Griffith Park at a barbecue.
Yeah.
And you're like, questioning your ability to care for this dog, and I just was getting to know you.
To be honest, I also questioned my ability to care for that dog.
And you have been such an awesome parent to that dog. Dog mom, dog parent, whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
And he's traveled with you, and you're always taking care of him, and that shows great character.
Yeah, I mean, I think I always say this about Huck, that, you know, I didn't want a dog. I actually, that associate,
wanted the dog.
Asked me to take this dog, and I expressed no interest in doing this.
Oh, is that the backstory?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So my friend at the time found this dog, couldn't take care of it because her family situation, didn't want to give it to a shelter, asked me to take the dog. We were both involved in like placing the dog at the vet. I believe that I paid for the neutering and everything. Mm-hmm. And then the understanding was that she was going to take it. Then I get a call from the vet. This dog needs to go. You need to get the dog out of the vet. It's been 3 weeks. And so, you know, but Huck has taught me, I've had so many situations where it would have been a lot easier to get rid of him. Moving across the country, moving across the state. And he has just taught me complete commitment. I mean, he and I are so committed to each other. Yeah. He's my longest relationship. I don't think I'd be married if I didn't have Huck.
Yeah, so. I mean, they do so much. They teach us so much on so many different levels.
Yeah, there are a million reasons that it shouldn't have worked, but on both ends, probably. I don't know that he was a fan at first either, but now
he loved you from the start.
Now we're enmeshed.
So back to the other questions, and Huck, if you're listening, I love you.
He probably is.
He definitely will be.
He will be.
And your mom's bringing you a surprise for me, Huck, enjoy it.
Tasty.
So going back to your family, so are there any embarrassing stories you can share, like growing up? Because I think embarrassment is a character builder.
Yeah, there are probably like a lot of embarrassing stories. Let me think. Embarrassing stories about me. Well, I hated clothes until I was like 6 years old. So we would go to the beach and, you know, or actually until I was about 8 years old, because I was a beanstalk until I was seven. Mm-hmm. And then I started gaining weight. So I was chubby. So it looked like I was more developed than I was, and it was time to like stop getting changed on the beach. So my mom was like, you know, Allie and Adam can still get changed on the beach, but you're going to have to go into the bathroom. It's fine. It's not a big deal. So instead of listening to them, I would run around the beach like naked with them chasing me. But like as a 7 or 8 year old, which is like a little too old to do that. So there are like tons of stories about people just being completely horrified. Also, when I was 2, I was speaking in full sentences and apparently being a nightmare in this like grocery store. And this guy had the management try to like kick me out, but I was like 2 years old. And so my dad ended up getting in like a physical fight outside of this store because I was being so bad that so many people had complained that like the management was trying to kick me out at 2 years old. I was just like it's a very rebellious child.
So do you have anything in your like in your teen years that was really embarrassing?
I guess the coming out story was embarrassing.
Oh goodness.
I
out in your teens?
18. Wow. I met this girl at a club that I was there as an ally with my friend. I met this girl and we started this relationship. Of course she had a girlfriend, but I didn't know that. And I was like in love with her. And so I had my own line in my room, but for some reason, like, I think the phone died. So I was using the regular line. So I'm talking to her. We were talking about like dating or something. Mm-hmm. And my sister hears. So she like runs upstairs or she's on the phone. And then she was like, Dad. And she like runs upstairs and she's like, Jenny's a dyke. And I was like, oh my God. So I like run after her. And then my dad in my total dad form was like, Jenny, are you a dyke? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, oh, okay. And I was like, are you okay with this? And he was like, yeah, it's like, you know, you can like bring whoever you want home. Just like, don't be weird in your room or whatever. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. Also, all of my neighbors, because the windows were open, heard like this thing. And then when I went out the next morning, all my neighbors were like, oh, I heard you're a dyke. And I'm like, oh my God, this is mortifying. So everyone in Merrick knew that I was gay, due to my sister being a psychopath. And it was terrible. It was fine because they were great, but it was also like completely uncomfortable and awkward.
Well, you win. You win.
That was a little weird.
That's awesome. That's fantastic, Jen. That's a fantastic story.
It was a little weird.
Oh my God. But your dad, I could totally see your dad.
He's like, oh, you're a dyke. Are you a dyke? I'm like, yeah. This is also the man that like read a book on girls getting their periods because I was too scared to get tampons until I was 20. Mm-hmm. So he would buy me tampons at the store and mail them to me in college because I was too embarrassed to get tampons. So he's like just a weird blend of amazing and bizarre.
He's amazing. That's amazing and a loving thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's
so
a weirdo.
Your dad.
He's just weird. Okay. Yeah.
So that leads me into the next thing. Cause you know, it sounds like were you shy anytime in your life?
I've never been shy.
But you're shy buying tampons.
Yeah. I was very shy buying tampons,
but everything else you weren't shy.
I was never shy. I'm very shy now. If you first meet me, I'm like not going to talk. I'm like at work. I don't really talk yet. Cause it's new. Mm-hmm. I'm shy in situations where I don't know anyone. But I'm not shy like anywhere else. Okay. I mean, yeah.
So do you identify as an introvert or an extrovert or an ambivert?
I think I'm
both.
An extrovert. However, with the stipulation that I need like my wife is a nurse and she works on the weekends twice a month.
Okay.
And one of the weekend days that she's working, I have to just be by myself and do nothing.
No.
But 6 other days of the week, I don't want to be alone ever and I want to be out. So it's like, I need a recharge time, but I don't need a recharge time every time I'm in a social setting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's fascinating because like Dr. Parker and I were obsessed about figuring out, well, she identifies as an introvert and I was very blatantly branded an extrovert at a work party. And I was just like, first of all, it was my former boss, and we were at a party for somebody's birthday, and she's like, "Well, you're an extrovert." And I'm like, you know, it's like, you know, yeah. it was just so rude, first of yeah. all, and second of all, it was too personal to share like that, because people don't know I was deathly shy growing up, so to do something like that to me in a party, and to brand me without me branding myself, I found very rude and very offensive. So I became obsessed with, you know, because there's a stereotype with extroverts that they're like, hey, yelling and screaming, like,
yeah,
ruling the world, you know, kicking sand on little guys on the beach. It was just, to me, there was like a stereotype.
Yeah, I just think it's about where you get your energy, yeah. you know?
And then I had to learn what yeah. you just said. It's where you get your energy. And
like, my wife gets her energy from reading solitary
yeah.
things. I definitely get fed by social interaction. Mm-hmm. I'm actually drained by, like, solitary things. Okay. I mean, they're
what about you. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, they're not... You know, like, I find it more work to, like, find stimulation in, well, not in reading, because that's stimulating, but, like, she knits. I would rather die. Okay. I would rather kill someone or myself than knit and, like, go to jail than knit. So, like.
That's not an extreme response. That's no. That's a responsible
I mean,
response.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So she tried to get me to knit, and that was almost a divorce. Like, it's yeah. just not something I'm ever.
And Kat is very patient and lovely and awesome.
Yeah. So we have very different. But put me in a social setting, and I will get the same fulfillment that she gets from.
Did this behavior lead to your political activism? How did you get involved politically? I see this being a tie-in into your political energy and your political yeah. activism. Yeah.
I've always, you know, when I was 10, my aunt died of AIDS, and when she got diagnosed when I was 8, and my teacher told me that it was contagious by touching. So robbed of really the last 2 years of her life, because she and I were extremely close. She was probably the closest person to me in my life. And once she got diagnosed, I became very, you know, I don't want her to touch me. I don't want any of this. And she can feel that. And she also, it was 94, so she, when she passed away. So she was suffering, like, she had really bad thrush. She lost her eyesight. She had dementia.
Oh,
and she was 28.
Hard.
So,
wow.
Yeah. So, and she just had a baby. I mean, so my
baby okay?
The baby was fine okay. and negative. My uncle is positive, but Jamie's negative. Hopefully no one hears this, because Jamie doesn't know her mom anymore.
Oh, wait a second. Okay, well, I can't. Okay. Well,
No. I mean, she won't. Okay. It's fine. So, but, you know, so my aunt died, and then I learned about what AIDS was after that. And so when I was 12, I started volunteering for Gay Men's Health Crisis in New York City, because I was just so angry that misinformation was easier to spread than the truth. And I think that's where it all started. I mean, from there, I learned about, even before I knew I was gay, you know, at Gay Men's Health Crisis, it was like there's intersectionality between HIV and homophobia. And then I was mm-hmm. like, oh, well, fuck that. I want to be like, I want to help, like, uplift this community that's being, you know, completely thrown under the bus by politicians mm-hmm. and healthcare systems and all these things. And it's sort of just, you know, I've always looked for opportunities to help marginalized communities that are not, you know, partially because I'm in some of those marginalized communities,
yes,
but
we both are, yeah.
You know, a lot of people are ignored, and the issues that catch on are the ones that are sexy and fun. Even look at Darfur. That was like the hot issue.
Yeah.
And now no one cares, and it's still going on.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I would say that my aunt definitely, I rode AIDS Life Cycle with her picture on my bike every year.
Is that why you wrote AIDS Life Cycle?
Yeah, I mean,
AIDS Life Cycle?
Most of my activism, I could definitely link back to my aunt, for sure.
Jen, I am getting a bit emotional. I didn't know, because I'm your friend, didn't I? I'm so sorry all that.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, when I turned 28, I remember...
I'm sorry for your loss. I'm sorry that you didn't get to touch her, because some idiot didn't give you the right information.
Yeah, I mean, the last time I saw her, she hugged me. It was like 3 days, or maybe 4 days before she died. And I, like, ran inside in front of everyone, bleached my whole body. I mean, it's like, because that's what
you
they tell,
know.
You know,
you
that's what
know.
They told you at that time. And, you know, she was 28. So when I turned 28, I remember thinking like, wow, today I'm like going with my friends and we're going to go eat Mexican food and hang out on the beach. Mm-hmm. And like in, you know, 10, 20 years ago, like my people that were turning 28 were having a much different experience. So, I mean, the strength and dignity and compassion and love that she exhibited during that time has definitely driven, you know, my desire, because I think that a lot of times when I talk to people, they're like, well, I don't want to help homeless people or addicts because they're just like, you know, they're angry, they're selfish, they're this, they're that. And I'm like, they're dealing, like what they're showing you externally is masking a level of fear and disenfranchisement.
Yes.
That is why you should be, you know, when I see someone who's angry or lashing out or agitated or whatever, you know, I look for what is driving that. And usually it's things that will, you know, spark empathy, not disgust or, yeah.
Or rage or anger or just a simpleton response of just shutting another human being out.
Yeah.
That's this is why I respect you so much. And I am like, this is where you say thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're such a wonderful person, and I'm learning so much more about you. And it's like, this is one of the things I like about doing this podcast, because I'm starting with people that I know, and then we're going to branch out to get to know more people. But it's like, I'm getting to know so much more about you, and we're friends.
Yeah.
I was at your wedding.
We know. We're very, very close friends.
Yeah, so you were involved. So you and I met during a political event known Prop 8 here in California. So how did you, so your AIDS activism with your aunt was a catalyst. How did you, and your passion for the disenfranchised. So this was a natural path, right?
Yeah. I worked at the LA Gay and Lesbian Center. You know, once I came out, like I definitely fell into siloing my activism around LGBT issues, which I forced myself to get out of recently because it's not advantageous. Like there are other groups, and like if queer people aren't going to stand up for Black people or stand up for disabled people, like then why do we want anyone else to stand up for us?
Yeah.
But for a long time, I was definitely in the queer bubble. So when Prop 8 happened, that was the first time in my life that I had ever faced discrimination for being gay. I mean, my family did not just ever give me a hard time. I worked in the queer sector, so I never got turned down for a job. Prop 8 was the first time that I had ever been told, no, you can't have this because you're gay. And I think a lot of the people that we organized with, that also was their experience. And so, you know, I saw that the campaign left out Latino people.
Oh, yeah.
It left out communities of color. It left out communities of faith. And I was just like, this is bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, this is not okay.
Yeah.
You know, it needs to be... We need to show people that we are worthy of rights, worthy of marriage. And the way to do that is not to only talk to the communities that already feel that we are.
Preaching to the choir doesn't work. I mean, I was working at this one particular organization that was trying to focus on Black and Latino empowerment and getting that kind of equality out to that particular community. And the power, and so I was involved in the state campaign as well, working with the other groups where we met. I remember sitting in San Francisco and Gavin Newsom came in, and I was sitting there and I was like, and I counted, it was me and my friend Jasper. We were the only two people of color sitting in the room. And then this gentleman came in that they hired, and they were hired a 60-year-old Anglo man with white hair to his shoulder. I remember very clearly. And he's like, this is how you talk to Black kids. And this is how you talk to brown Mexican kids. And I was sitting there going, oh my God.
Yeah.
And then I felt very devalued because I'm from the community. And so was my friend Jasper. And we were both majorly politically involved. And we were trying to get the messaging out about marriage equality with no money.
Yeah.
And it was just, and we were going full grassroots.
Well, that's the problem is, you know, funding is racist, and funding is, like, I just read this book called Winners Take All, about how, you know, NGO funding or funding, nonprofit sector funding is designed to uphold the same, you know, the same systems and the same dynamics that we all exist in. So like it's meant to uphold corporate culture, white culture. And so if you look at like a lot of, you know, foundations that are geared towards communities of color that are run by people of color, they're not funded because they're disrupting the system that that people that are in power want.
And they also want these communities and organizations of colors to respond in the communication form that they're used to, which is, you know, Anglo-based or corporate-based. And they don't, and if you have to change your language to that particular way of answering, and, you know, and then also if you answer and you give facts that are going to serve the community, the funder doesn't understand it at times.
Yeah.
So it gets click, it gets stamped, no, try again. But but hopefully with people like you and some other people, things will start changing and becoming
and
better.
People like you say thank you.
Thank you. Touche. Air high five. Awesome. I love it. So let's go into the public speaking portion of this. So are you comfortable public speaking in front of people or in small groups? Tell me.
I'm better at public speaking in large groups, actually.
Okay.
That does not intimidate me ever. Small groups, it's harder for me because I think that it's easier to tell if your tone or your subject matter is not resonating, mm-hmm. you know right away. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you have to completely change your entire thing on the spot, and they watch you through that process. And that to me is more scary. Like if I'm giving a presentation at work for 10 people, and I can tell that I'm losing 8 of the people in the room.
That's the worst
like,
feeling.
They are going to see me like completely. And then it seems disingenuous because I'm going off. You know, I obviously went there with like a set of ideas. And I'm clearly like having to deviate from that because I can tell that it's not working. And I feel like that creates like a weird dynamic that I don't like. But large groups, I do find it easier and I like it actually.
I find when I'm in small groups and that starts happening, I instantly start pulling them in.
Yeah.
Okay, you're not interested. So I engage them instantly. And then,
I try.
Well, that's great. But I do that because I'm like, okay, if you're not interested, I'm going to pull you in and I'm going to ask you questions. So you have to engage. And then I notice other people start getting engaged. Like, yeah. And it's not about humility and controlling. It's like, if you're bored, it's my job to keep you engaged. So I'm going to engage you. I'm going to ask you questions and pull you in. So I like small groups better. Either's fine, but I love when small groups go really well.
Yeah.
I've been in small groups when they've gone sideways and it's just like, oh my God, this 25 minutes is like 3 hours.
Yeah. Small groups when they go well, I love because you get more feedback and you can like actually have this really collaborative thing. Mm-hmm. But when they just, I recently started helping my friend out with her ballet nonprofit, and it's a group of like queer activist eccentric artists.
Nice.
That couldn't be further from me. I mean, I've worked in fundraising my whole life, and they know that, and they can smell that, and I have to speak in front of this group all the time, and it doesn't go well a lot of the time. And I think that like experiences like that have definitely scarred me a bit. But when it goes well, I love smuggers. But yeah, I definitely get a lot more nervous when it's like 10 people.
Did you learn to public speak in school, or did you have a skill ahead of time? Is it something that you just had naturally and you honed it, or were you taught that?
We definitely didn't cover it in school. I sadly gave a lot of eulogies as a kid. Like,
oh my God, Jen.
Yeah, I know. So my aunt, that within 6 months of each other, my aunt, my Taekwondo teacher, who I was the only photo in his house, he and I spent 7 days a week together. And like his family, I mean, we got to his wake and it was literally just photos of me and him.
Aww.
And then my aunt, my grandfather, and then him. And so I gave, they asked me to give like the eulogies at all those funerals. And I know it sounds morbid, but it, what it taught me is that sometimes you have to, you can use your emotions to drive you, but in public speaking, if you lead completely by emotion, you actually end up losing a lot of the people in the room because it's uncomfortable for them. People aren't comfortable with emotions. So it's very strange, but at like 10 years old, I learned how to use my emotions to create a speech that was powerful, but how to detach from them enough to like deliver that. And then after that, I did poetry. And so I would constantly have to like say poems at these like competitions. And it just sort of happened organically where, you know, I saw what worked with other people and I sort of just mirrored that.
Okay.
Yeah, but they didn't cover it in school and they didn't cover it in college. It was more just like trial and error.
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons Public Words Project was birthed, because when I went to school, it wasn't, I even took public speaking, but like, so what you're saying is like, that's why Public Words Project came about, because there's a need, even with a college education, yeah, with or without an education, but like, you know, you spend all this time getting this theory-driven degree. And then I've seen some presentations from grad students, even it's just like, I'm like, whoa, do not read the PowerPoint.
And oh yeah.
I'm
yeah.
like, don't read the PowerPoint.
Even in grad school, yeah, like we had presentations today and it was like, what are you doing?
Yeah. And I was just sitting there like, oh my God, this grad student's reading the PowerPoint. I mean, just with their back to the audience. But, and then I was talking to some professors I know, and then I just started coaching the students, and I've been doing that for a while.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. You're great at it. Yeah.
Well, thank you. She will get a plug for that. I think I have to pay her a little bit of money for that, but you learned organically, you mirrored people and you trial and error. That's fantastic.
And I was always a confident kid. I mean, my brother and sister are very different from me and they're very similar to each other. They were growing up. And so, you know, I was always gregarious. I was always outspoken, you know, and people would always, you know, I started talking extremely early. And mm-hmm. so people were always giving me positive reinforcement about mm-hmm. like, oh, you know that word, that you're so, you know, that's great. Your vocabulary is great. And like, I think that positive reinforcement, whether it's deserved or not, like it really does. Like I had a lot of confidence in speaking, you know, from a very young age. And I think that like the kids that I see that don't do well with public speaking, a lot of it's because they've been discouraged or they've been told that, you know, they're not good at it or that they, you know, people don't like listening to them. So
yeah, that negative reinforcement comes from someplace, that comes from the coaches or the teachers.
Yeah, I think like it's important to, you know, anyone can be a public speaker if they,
you know, they did that old school, like negative reinforcement. They did it. It doesn't work that well.
Yeah.
Know? So it's a balance between the two. I mean, I didn't play football, but I understand that they like berate people and that's how they break them down and build them up. And
yeah.
I also didn't join the Marines or the military, but that's, I understand they berate them, break them down and build them up.
Yeah.
It's purposeful. But you know, when you're in a grammar school or you're a little kid trying to figure your shit out, it's better to hold one's hand than slap them behind upside
the head. For sure. And my teachers were always supportive and, you know, I was very lucky in that, you know, I've been surrounded by people that responded to what I was doing really well. And I see a lot of kids that don't have that. And, you know, I wanted to actually get into coaching in Brooklyn because I think a lot of the kids that go through the public school system, especially in the inner city in New York, they don't get that opportunity. Mm-hmm. They don't get the positive reinforcement. They just get the negative reinforcement in school and out. All right.
So Jen, again, impressed by you on so many different levels. So I'm going to ask you this question. So I consider you an LGBTQ leader. I know the acronym keeps changing, but right now we're going to say LG. So as an LGBTQ leader, what are your responsibilities?
I mean, I think my responsibility is to, you know, to never accept that there is one definition of an LGBTQ movement. I think that, you know, a lot of times you have people that are like, I'm a leader within this community, within this movement, and this is the definition, and it's a static definition. Mm-hmm. I think that my job as a leader, as a queer leader, as an LGBTQ leader, is to constantly be like, who are you not hitting? Mm-hmm. Who are you not encompassing? Who are you not including? Mm-hmm. You know, at work, we work on abortion. And one of the first things we do in any country that we're working in is we reach out to the religious community. And people think that's insane and weird because, you know, the Christian community we reach out to. Yeah. And like the Christian community is not a community that is the traditionally pro-abortion. Mm-hmm. But that's why we reach out to them. Mm-hmm. Because like if we can get those leaders on board, mm-hmm. then we're going to be able to actually have a bigger table to have a seat at. Mm-hmm. And so I think that like part of my job as a leader in this community is to be like, oh, you're not reaching out to people that are religious because you think that they hate you. Mm-hmm. If they hate you, then change their mind. Then find a way to connect to them. Don't just accept bigotry and hatred and say, well, that's them. They're stupid. They're not as good as me. They're not as smart as me. They're not as great as me. So that's why they hate. People hate because they don't know. I mean, exactly. If you look at the last election, I have all these friends that are like, fuck Trump supporters. I want nothing to do with them. I'm going to unfriend them. I hate them. Listen, I hate them too. And I want to, that's my gut instinct is to be like, I don't want to be friends with you on Facebook because you're ignorant. But I forced myself to engage in conversations with these people to say, okay, you're against the migrant caravan. You think that immigration is the number one issue plaguing America. Tell me more about that. Where does that come from? What experiences are you drawing from? Because clearly, is it Kat?
Mm-hmm. Okay, keep going.
Okay. Because, you know, I think that these people that are like, I hate immigrants and I hate the migrant caravan, like they're clearly going from something, from some experience that they're falsely connecting to.
Right, right.
A group of vulnerable people that are trying to escape like oppression that no one in the US would ever understand. So
right,
I mean like
right.
So that's what I think my responsibility is, to continue to question and push people to get outside of the pink bubble. And
the pink bubble, I like that.
Okay. To look for ways to connect to people that seem to have nothing to do with you.
And the fantastic Kat just walked in here.
She
Kat,
did.
Say hello.
Hi.
So advice for youth as they get comfortable in their skin.
You know, I would just say don't look to the media to make yourself feel like you're represented, because I think what a lot of times it happens is, and I did this too, you come out and you want to feel comfortable in your skin, so you look to what is safe and comfortable and anonymous to find validation in, and that's the media. And I think that the media does a lot of good sometimes, but a lot of times it shows you an archetype mm-hmm. of a gay person that you might not fit into. And then you actually start to feel worse.
That's been part of history.
And you feel like you need to change yourself, you need to cut your hair, you need to lose weight, you need to gain weight, you need to do whatever. So I would say just like find a community that accepts you, and if it doesn't exist in the place that you live, then, and you have the means and you have the ability, like find some place where there's a community that is going to say, you as you are is exactly who you need to be. You don't need to be more gay. You don't need to be less gay. You're perfect. And I know that that's a lot of times like people are finding that online. I don't think it needs to be a physical place that you move to, but just find a group of people that lift you up for who you are, and don't try to point out how you could better fit into the community. I guess.
That so, we just had advice for young people. So what are some words of wisdom for people in general? And we're going to end on that.
Love more. Just love more. I think that the world is really fractured and fucked up. Am I allowed to curse?
It's fine.
I think that the world is really fractured and hurting right now. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, my temple was just a face of swastikas, you know, Charlottesville happened. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that what would be great right now for people to do is just to find a way to love everyone. You know, even if someone, it is so hard for me every day. I am confronted with people that are, you know, ignorant, that I think are completely political on the opposite, politically on the opposite side of me. Mm-hmm. What I've learned to do is just find ways to have compassion and empathy for them. And it's made me a better activist and it's made me a better person. I'm less negative. I'm not doing my activism from a place of anger, which is helpful sometimes, but really hurtful and harmful in other ways. I think that if people could just try to find middle ground more and try to find ways to relate to different communities, there's going to be a lot more cohesiveness, which I know is easy to say, but like, you know, I think that what's going on right now is we're angry, we're pissed off, we should be. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that I'm not in the streets. I'm not like protesting. That I'm not supporting organizations that are protesting. But what I'm saying is that rather than scream at someone and tell them that they're wrong, mm-hmm. I choose to like focus on like, you hate me, but look at the love that I have. Look at the love that's in my life. Like, how can you hate like two women that love each other? How can you hate like a kid that has two game? Like, I don't know. I'm just trying to approach things from a more positive, loving angle.
I think love and compromise are the key. And I see no weakness in compromise. I think compromise is strength. So that's why. So thank you. So for everyone, be brave, love more. And I want to thank you, Jen Spinner, for being part of our podcast.
No, thank you for having me. And thank you, Kat, for delivering our food.
Thank you, Kat, for being here. And I can't wait till you guys move here.
Same.
All right, everyone, spread the word, spread the love. Tell everyone to listen to Public Words Project. Thank you.
Bye.